We're starting. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty, and I got a round table today. We're going to talk about supervillains. It's the subject du jour. And joining us today, I guess we haven't had in a long time, Mr. Charles Rice. How you doing, Chuck?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah, glad to have you. And I guess for longtime listeners, I might remember Chuck. Chuck, you were a guy at RPG Objects for a while, and then you were a guy at Vigilance Press, was your old imprint for a lot of years.
Yes.
And now you are, what are you doing at Mayfair?
I work in marketing. So I write press releases. I deal with, kind of frontline contacts, talk to a lot of advertisers. It's kind of cool.
Sweet, sweet. You ever miss game writing?
Yes.
Okay.
As evidenced by the fact that he still does it. He just doesn't get paid for it.
I barely got paid for it even then.
Well, that's true. That's true. Right, fair enough.
That is the nature of the industry.
I'll give a call out to Brandon Blackmore, who gave me advice on role-playing writing years ago when he published my first book. He said, there's a real secret to making a small fortune in gaming. Start with a large fortune.
Yes.
True.
All right. Well, hey, I guess let's talk about the guy who was just talking last. That's Jason Tounder, a.k.a. Dr. Comics, who's here with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, as always. I'm sorry that I missed the diversity in comics panel, because I wanted to be there so bad. But
that was a fun one, actually.
Yeah, well, I had to teach. Okay.
Yeah. We got so carried away, we forgot to pimp Green Hornet's latest Kickstarter.
You've fallen down on your job, man.
And what are the chances we would forget to pimp something on this podcast?
With this group, pretty low.
So, anyway, and speaking of pretty low, Mr. Walt Rebilliard's with us today.
I guess true. I am only 5'5".
What? I didn't know that.
Yeah, 5'5", you know, but I have to make up for it with a big personality and, very fast punching.
You're like Sylvester Stallone height.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. Only I don't have that weird lip thing going on.
How tall is Wolverine?
5'2".
5'2", okay, well, there you go.
I was very heartened by that when, I was always a small kid, and I took to martial arts early because I got sick of getting beat up.
Yeah.
One of my friends handed me, I first got into X-Men, one of my friends handed me my first X-Men book when I was in 7th grade, 8th grade, and I was just shocked by this little dude just ripping into everybody. He was suddenly my favorite, not because he was an anti-hero or whatever, but because he was handy capable. He was the short guy that was making it work.
That's right.
Wow, so Wolverine's kind of your spirit animal.
I got the hair everywhere. I don't have the claws yet, but, I do have a large assortment of bladed weapons real close, so I'm good.
Well, you have to keep in mind, I don't think Wolverine had the skeleton when he was your age either. I think he was,
It's true. I think I have, I think I have 100 more years to go before I get that skeleton, so according to current continuity. Sorry, Abe.
Something to look forward to. That's good.
It's true.
And Abe Smith is also with us.
Yeah, hello there.
And Aid is here under doctor's orders. He has to come and spew his bile about comics on a regular basis.
It's terrible.
Aid is our token accent.
Yes, apparently so.
And speaking of bile, Mr. Chris McLaughlin of Green Ronin fame has just joined us.
I'm Sal. Don't I count as having an accent?
Indeed.
I live in Georgia, man. You sound local.
Oh, okay. Okay, fair enough.
He's calling you a damn townie, Chris. So, Chris, glad you're here. This is the podcast where we're talking about supervillains. And I think you know everyone on the panel except for Mr. Chuck Rice, so I don't think we've had you guys talking to each other in a while.
Okay. Hello.
Hi.
Chuck is quite loquacious, as you can tell. Chuck does PR at Mayfair Games, and they publish all kinds of games like Settlers of Catan, etc. And Chuck's the guy who used to run Vigilance Press, and before that he was kind of would you call you the writer in charge at RPG Objects?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, so, Chris, congratulations on your Annie nomination.
Thank you very much.
If there's somebody else here that was also nominated who I have missed, forgive me.
No.
All right, so congratulations, Chris. That's awesome. And it was for, Emerald City?
Yeah, we're up for Best Electronic Book.
Oh, right on.
Cool.
Excellent.
Yeah, congratulations. That is awesome.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is your eighth nomination.
Really nice as well, by the way. The physical book is brilliant of him. We'll see. I love it. So.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I've got three copies upstairs, actually.
Cool.
Holy crap.
Well, I did some minor writing on the book, so they're all writer's copies.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So, yeah, I'm considering giving away on the podcast. I don't know. Because I only need one, really, no matter how much the setting. So, hey, let's do a giveaway on this podcast. To the funniest comment, I'll send you my copy, one of my extra copies of Emerald City.
Oh, this is going to go south very fast.
That's a great prize. That's awesome.
That's a bargain.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if we have any actually listeners engaged enough and funny enough to win it. So, well, anyway, so today we're talking about supervillains, best and worst. And Chris, since you just joined late, you get to go first.
All righty. Best supervillain. To me, the best supervillain is the type that, in some ways, is almost a hero. You kind of understand where they're coming from, even if in the end you don't agree with them.
Yeah.
And honestly, as much as I probably am a DC guy, this is a place where I think, for the most part, Marvel just kind of owns DC and always has.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you think Marvel, you think about guys like Doctor Doom.
Yeah.
Who, for all the terrible things that he does, it comes back to the fact that he loves his mom. Most people can get behind that. And, I mean, you know, so much has been said and written about Magneto. Gee, I mean, it's, you know, I'm just throwing him in just so that we can say that we didn't completely ignore him. But, you know, I mean, here's a guy who's been through one genocide and doesn't particularly feel like going through another. Yeah. You know, I mean, what a great motivation for a villain. Okay. Now, those I think are your A-list villains. Those are the ones that I think kind of nudge you in the direction of comics being a little more than just you know, entertainment for kids for a dime during the Depression. You know, but you know, there's sort of an odd class of villains that has been fascinating to me more than those usual go-to ones of late, because I was listening to a commentary track on. I've been doing two a night, so please forgive me if I can't remember exactly which one. But the person doing the commentary track read a quote from Alfred Hitchcock that I have never heard before, but I've absolutely fallen in love with it. Apparently, Hitchcock had a theory that the audience will root for anybody as long as they're good at their job.
Oh. Yeah.
And it just explained to me why I love so many of the films that I do. Like, since I was a kid, I've loved the abominable Dr. Fibes, about a guy who kills 11 doctors and nurses. You know, but the thing is, he's really good and clever about it, so you wind up rooting for him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, now granted, he's Vincent Price, that doesn't hurt anybody in my book, you know, but still in all, you know, there's this whole class of villains that we root for simply because they're good at what they do. And that
to explain the popularity of Dexter.
Yeah, yeah. Or tying it back into comics, the Joker.
Yeah.
It's impossible to actually root for the Joker, and yet he's incredibly compelling because he's good at what he does. He has a style about it. And, you know, even though I think that's maybe a shade below a villain that you can actually kind of sympathize with a time or two, I think that's where DC villains actually kind of make up at least a little bit of ground. Like, for instance, all of us who have a sneaking or in my case, open love for the Flash's rogues gallery.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the only thing you can say about these guys is, wow, you have a gun that instantly reduces things to absolute zero, and you're choosing to rob banks with it rather than just patent that and live off the royalties. You know, you gotta love that. So that's kind of my take on comic villains there.
So who's your least favorite?
Least favorite villain. Okay, now this may be a bit of a personal bias. But for me, I don't think there's ever, at least in my recorded comic book history. Now, please keep in mind, when I say worst, I'm not talking about villains that are just simply dated and hilarious. So no picking on Stilt Man or Kite Man here. Okay, you know, they had their era, you know. But for me, the absolute worst villain that I've ever come across is the main baddie in Zero Hour, Extant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, his name is Extant?
Or extant? I don't know. I'm from the south.
Yeah, but no, that's wow. That's bad.
There you go. My good colleague has already put his finger on one of it. It's a name that somebody pulled out of a thesaurus, like way too many 90s characters.
Yeah.
Okay. He's never been seen before, and he's only been seen once since, and that's when Jeff Johns brought him back just to kill him.
Yeah.
And by the way, thank you, Jeff Johns. I owe you for that. If I ever see you, sir, I'll buy you a beverage of your choice for killing Extant. Yeah. So he's a villain. He has no stated motivation. He was brought in for one purpose, and that's to kill off the Justice Society, who DC thought was making the rest of their characters seem old.
Yeah.
So rather than use any of their usual rogues gallery, like Vandal Savage, you know, or Per Degaton, how much sense would it have made for it to have been Per Degaton? I mean, even if you have to kill off the JSA in the stupidest, least glorious, least interesting way possible, at least have it be a villain that makes some kind of sense. But no, we have Extant. In the costume, it looks like something out of Todd McFarlane's reject pile.
Wow.
Extant was like created to be the Zero Hour guy. Like they knew that they wanted to do another Crisis, and they didn't mm-hmm. have a villain that could do it, so they created this guy just for that storyline.
Well, I disagree that it couldn't have been another villain. I mean, I rattled off two myself right there.
Yeah,
and worst of all,
I don't mean killing the JSA. I mean the whole like all the reality alteration and his, you know, basically ending the cosmos to create a new one. Right?
Well, in the end, Time Trapper, Glorith.
Sure. Yeah.
But one more thing about him. Okay. The one other thing about Extant that we know about is that he's another one of these guys that's secretly Hawk. He's another guy that's secretly Hank Hall.
I thought he was, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Something that didn't work the first time and had been mocked for five solid years before, DC's going to give that one more shot. Yeah, he's secretly Hawk.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, if it had been Funky Flashman under that mask, I would have been more impressed. I mean,
if he had been Hawk from the Spencer novels, just Avery Brooks under there.
Oh man, you just took my $3, sir. I bought that comic. You know, for me, Extant by a mile. Zero Hour remains the.
Yeah.
With the possible exception of Chuck Austin and Joe Kelly's runs on JLA, the worst comics I've ever actually paid money for.
Yeah, it's hard to defend Zero Hour. I certainly am not going to try. Yeah.
It looks good compared to the New 52.
I don't know. Yeah. They're very similar, actually, in a lot of ways.
Well, New 52 is such a big target. I mean, it's so big I can actually find parts of it I like. Zero Hour just made me feel ripped off and offended, and worst comics I've paid money for, with the Chuck Austin exception, possibly.
The Chuck Austin exception.
Well, hey, let me throw in a quick interruption here. That was Chris McLaughlin talking, who is one of the many fine writers contributing to Mutants and Masterminds books. So we just talked about him being nominated. Blackworm Publishing, friend of the podcast, they have a Kickstarter right now to put out a series of books for Mutants and Masterminds called The Algernon Files 3.0.
That's an amazing book in previous editions. Are they just updating it for the new system?
It looks like that's what's going on. They're updating and expanding because every stretch goal is going to be a new book. They got 15 days left. They're about 1,000 bucks down. They could use your help. I'll put a link in the show notes.
I have the hardback of the previous edition on my shelf, and it's awesome. I never ran a game in that setting, but I just ripped the characters all out and reskinned them. And ran them in my own M&M campaign, and it was awesome. So, and it's very well written.
Yeah, it's well written. Aaron Sullivan's involved as well, his name you probably know from other projects. And Alex Williamson as well. So, yeah, it's well worth a look, and we'll have the link in the show notes. And we're hoping to get one of those guys on Monday for a separate podcast. But just thought I would mention it before I forgot. So, Well, hey, Chris, thanks for your input. And
you're very welcome, sir.
Let's move on to Chuck Rice, since it's been a while since we've had him here. Chuck, who's your favorite and least favorite villains?
Well, my favorite villain has already been mentioned.
Yeah.
And it would be Magneto, specifically because if you're going to set up a conflict between two groups, and comics often fail at this, the one running the bad side, you just look at it and you're like, what moron would follow him? Because he's evil and he doesn't care about them and he's, you know, or whatever. He's just greedy. There's so many reasons. Whereas Magneto, you can see a reasonable person. Like, you can see Colossus or Quicksilver looking around and going, man, I don't know, the good guys kind of suck. This guy, he sounds pretty smart.
Yeah, yeah. Especially as time goes by and the war kind of goes back and forth.
And as Cyclops and Professor X get dumber, which I don't understand how that happens, but it seems to have happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't they just turn Cyclops into a villain for a while?
Yes.
Yeah, he was. Well, we could do a whole podcast about Cyclops. But
every writer since Chris Claremont, as near as I can tell, their goal is to ruin Cyclops. I don't know how this happened. There was apparently a secret meeting somewhere, and they were like, look, this guy is too cool. He's cooler than Wolverine. Everyone honestly knows that deep in their heart of hearts. And so we just have to break him down because we don't know why.
See, I'm with you, Chuck, okay? I'm a huge fan of the character. But most people disagree with us because
well, they're wrong.
Yeah, they are. Cyclops is like the wet blanket. He's like the guy that's always telling Wolverine to put those claws back, you know, like shape up and rein it in. And that's not what readers want to see. They don't want to see that. They want to be with Walt. They want the scrappy guy to cut loose, right? And so the authority figure who's like acting like dad, you know, the straight man, he's always going to come in behind. Now, what's actually going on?
Give that statement. Explain the success of Batman.
Pardon?
Isn't Batman the authority figure who acts like dad?
Well, no, because he bucks authority. He breaks the law to enforce the law.
Okay, you're right.
I mean, he's a vigilante. But so actually, although to you and to me, it looks to me like Cyclops is being ruined. The people at Marvel actually think that they're making him more cool by making him an anti-hero.
See, but what that misses is the honest appeal of Cyclops, and this was fully illustrated when Claremont took Professor X out of the X-Men for a while, and then he brought him back, and Professor X tried to run Wolverine, and Wolverine like walked up to Cyclops, and he's like, look, boss, you need to handle this. Like, Cyclops was the first lieutenant, and Wolverine was the sergeant major. And that is a concept that comic writers beyond Chris Claremont don't seem to understand. Cyclops got to be the leader. Wolverine did what he said because he respected him, but then there would also be those times when Cyclops would be like, okay, that needs to be handled in any way possible. Wolverine, you run that way, I'm going to turn my back and walk the opposite direction as quickly as I can. Just handle it for me. Yeah. Don't tell me how, please.
Are you talking about Remender's run on X-Force?
I could talk about Cyclops all day, so we should shut up.
Yes. Because we're talking about villains, and Cyclops is not one of them. I don't care what they say.
So who's your least favorite villain?
My least favorite villain is the Beyonder.
Oh. That's a great pick. Now,
that is a good pick.
So tell us, expand on this, if you would, Mr. Rice.
He's like a dumb little kid with ultimate power.
Yeah.
And it's like Secret Wars was so good because you never saw him.
Yeah, right.
Like, he was the kid. He just brought all the toys into his room and locked the door and then just watched what happened. And that aspect of him is cool. But then you get Secret Wars 2, where he's running around in the tracksuit and he's just walking around New York City somehow. And I don't understand. I don't even understand.
One of my favorite storylines ever came out of that, which is when he turned the skyscraper to gold. And Spider-Man got, like, he had to wrestle with whether or not he was going to keep this Steno notebook that had been turned to gold.
I remember that, yeah. Yeah.
And I remember him like carrying this fucking steno notebook of gold around for issues, wondering, what am I going to do with this? Until finally he throws it in the river. And I guess maybe that's just an example of a good writer taking a stupid idea and making something good out of it.
Right. And only the boss could come up with an idea that bad and get it in print. That's what happened.
You mean Jim?
Everyone was like, yeah, Jim Shooter, Jim, yeah. this is a terrible idea, boss. Shut up. Get out of my office.
So Secret Wars 2, was the Beyonder basically like Steve Guttenberg meets Mr. Mitzelflick?
Yes. There's a point at which he's like picking up babes and he's just been eating ice cream the whole time, and so he's gotten fat and he realizes they don't like what he looks like, so he just makes himself thin again. Like, it's so weird.
That's
what's happening?
It's Boom Boom, unless I'm very much mistaken. You're talking about there.
Basically, he turns into like a Star Trek original series villain. Like,
that's exactly what I was going to say. Exactly, yeah. What I was going to say. He's the annoying little child kid that goes, Enterprise, I will manipulate. Yeah.
Right.
He's like the Squire of Gothos, right?
Yes.
Did exactly. You guys, right. did you guys catch his retconned origin in Illuminati a couple years back?
What?
The Beyonder? Terrible,
yeah.
Terrible idea.
No. What is this new origin?
Well, Aid, why don't you go ahead and enlighten me?
Okay. From what I know of, he is supposed to be a mutant inhuman, unless I'm very much mistaken. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
Yes.
He was a mutant inhuman, and when the Terrigen Mist hit him, he got this incredible godlike power.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
And so then he disappeared for 20 years and then decided to host a contest of champions?
Yeah, basically. And
why
then,
would you do that? I mean, why would you hook him in? Why would you make him an inhuman?
I really don't know, but he basically just showed up for one issue. It might have been a filler issue, honestly. And then Black Bolt commanded him at the advice of Namor to go away, and because he was an Inhuman, he obeyed his king and just fucked off.
Well, maybe that's why they did it, because they needed a good excuse to get rid of him.
Maybe.
Oh, well, that would they need. Well, how do we tie up the Beyonder? He's too powerful for anybody to make him go away. He has to choose to go away.
You get rid of him by pretending it never happened, which they've been really good at.
That is true, yeah.
But, you know, in a way, doesn't the Beyonder suffer from a lot of the problems that Extant has? A villain you've never heard of before, of extremely vague motivation, who's there simply to be really powerful and make the plot happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, but it worked once. And I guess maybe it's kind of one of those things where you should be smart enough to just be like, whew, man, I sure pulled a rabbit out of my hat there. I should just quietly walk away.
I shouldn't try to do it again.
Well, you know, I thought it was very interesting that you described him as the kid who collects all the toys, because according to Shooter, the whole reason for Secret Wars was to seal a toy licensing deal for Marvel.
Sure.
And the whole reason that it was Secret Wars is because the toy company told him those two words tested very well with toy buying age kids.
But, yeah, I still
have... Which sort of makes you wonder how it didn't wind up being Marvel Fart Battle, right? You know?
I think I might have some of those action figures in a box somewhere deep in my attic.
Yeah, I have Spider-Man Electro and a repainted Black Spider-Man to look like Spawn.
All right, cool. So, in fairness, in Secret Wars 1, the Beyonder wasn't really a character. He was just a plot device.
Right.
And that worked. I mean, as I had mentioned, he's basically a Star Trek original series villain. That he's just, you know, it's like putting Jim and the Lizard Man on the same planet and, you know, saying fight it out.
Exactly.
Right.
Or the rock alien that brings back Lincoln. And...
Exactly. Yeah.
What a great episode.
Well, hey, Jason, since you're talking right now... most and least favorite Superman.
I'm always talking. That's no excuse. there's only one character that I have a statue of that overlooks my comics collection, and that is Victor Von Doom. I have a long affection for Victor. I think he's great, and Chuck touched on the whole business of how he goes down to hell every year to fight for the soul of his mother, which finally was resolved in that brilliant early Mike Mignola piece, Triumph and Torment graphic novel, one of Marvel's early graphic novels, which is just an amazing, I just love the hell out of that book. And Doom's another example of that character that again, that Chris was talking about, who, you know, you can kind of identify with, and he's a tyrant, but everybody in this country is so happy, right? Just and now, the different writers portray this differently. Some portray the people as not really happy. They're only happy because there's guards sitting behind them with guns. Other people portray them as actually happy, that he actually does run Latveria as this kind of paradise country. It's just that nobody has any freedoms. And although the 2099 series earns tons of flack, I actually have a complete collection of it. And Doom 2099 is a great series. The end gets very wacky, but he's a really interesting kind of anti-hero, you know? It's like, look, all I want to do is run the country, run the world for its own good. I mean, is that so bad? And so he's very identifiable, and he has another great advantage over other villains in that I learned vocabulary from Dr. Doom.
Yes.
I mean, not every villain can pull off calling somebody a witless poltroon, you know? And when you're 9, this is how I learned to read, man. So Doom is articulate, and now, of course, he can be written badly. Just as we talked about how a great writer can take a terrible story and make a jewel out of it. A lousy writer can take a great character like Doom and make him into the most schlocky, megalomaniac, you know, melodramatic villain ever. But Doom stands in a very small group, you know, of just really, I think, standout villains who have influenced other villains. And he got to put the Mac on Storm along with a couple of other great
villains. I was just going to say, my favorite Doom moment is that the X-Men are in Latveria.
Yeah.
And he's got traps for everyone else, but yeah. He spends the entire time just macking on Storm. He's like, okay, look, I have minions to take care of these losers. I want to know who that is. I want to know who she is, and I want to have dinner with her.
Yeah, Storm is like, oh, he is so compelling. Yeah, he's great. It's a great sequence.
Well, you think about it, Doom is very much like Black Panther, and so that's who she winds up going with.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Interesting connection, yeah. They're
kind of the same asshole, right?
Well, you know, obviously she admires power, right? It's kind of this power fantasy thing.
So the Emperor Doom graphic novel, great or terrible?
Oh. Everybody in the world except for like a couple of the X-Men?
A couple of the Avengers.
Oh, yeah.
It's Wonder Man's best story ever because he's in an isolation chamber when he takes over the whole world using the Purple Man. And Wonder Man gets out and manages to rally a few of the Avengers, and they defeat Doom, but there's a scene where Doom could stop them.
Yeah.
But he's so sick of the bullshit of running the world.
Yeah.
He doesn't press the red button. He lets them defeat him, and he goes back to Latveria.
Yeah, I think that people that... There's something that a lot of people do when they write villains, and that's the idea that it's the struggle that makes the villain pleased. It's the struggle that animates him. And so if he's running the world, well, it's no fun anymore. In fact, I think that even happens in Emperor Doom. He's like, oh, you know, I'll give you Thor, right? Just to make it a challenge. I don't remember how that plays out, but yeah, it's kind of mediocre. I mean, it's interesting. But,
yeah, I just always stuck out because it's the one time I'm like, okay, Wonder Man doesn't suck in this, so it's
right. Yeah,
otherwise, I'm like, who's Wonder Man? He's like that event, one of the Avengers. You're like, why is he even on the team? Who is this guy?
He's on the team because of that awesome safari jacket. That's why he's on the team.
That's exactly what he's like.
Yes.
Can you
doing the Roger Moore look? That's what it is.
Triathlon to me then. Mm.
Yeah, that story really sounds like a total ripoff of the last story arc they did back in the 70s in Supervillain Team-Up, only they threw in Magneto for good measure, and it was sounds like a much better story that way.
Well,
it might have been.
Emperor Doom is 80, so it wasn't even that much after Supervillain Team-Up. I mean, I don't think it was unrelated, frankly, I guess it's all the same. If I had to pick a least favorite villain, it's hard to say because there's so many wonderfully bad villains in... Chris already told me I can't say Stiltman, so...
Mark Waid is...
Paste Pot Pete.
I cannot dump on Paste Pot Pete because friend of the blog, Jess Nevins, who is the author of many wonderful books on Victorian and pulp characters, as well as Alan Moore's League books, and he's done a Fables Encyclopedia. Jess Nevins is to the Trapster's number one fan and has a whole novel planned out starring Paste Pot Pete. So, no, I cannot dump on that guy. But what I will note is I agree that DC's villains are often not as interesting. They have a smaller number of good villains. They have Darkseid, they have Joker, and they have a few others. But what I think that we see, what I notice and what I think supports this idea is that DC seems to have a big anxiety over its own villains. It's always doing these plots in which, like, some mysterious bad guy shows up and makes all of their villains more powerful. Like, it's almost like DC is acknowledging our villains kind of suck, so we're going to try to modernize them. And as we all know, whenever you try to modernize something in DC, what you really do is you make it more like the 90s.
You know, you made me think of just something very interesting.
Yeah.
I think maybe the ultimate piece of evidence to back up what you're saying right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Look at pretty much the only story DC can publish right now. Superman turns evil. Or
yeah.
There's an evil
yeah.
Superman.
And
he rips somebody's limb, and somebody gets a limb ripped off.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, isn't the ultimate acknowledgement that you don't have no faith in your villains is you have to make one of your you have to turn one of your heroes into a bad guy?
And it's been interesting because maybe you could argue, well, we've been talking about Secret Wars for the last 15 minutes, and Secret Wars is all about a situation in which, you know, the heroes and the villains did the heroes do much fighting each other in Secret Wars?
There's a whole thing with the X-Men that nobody trusts them because they're
and so they go off on their own.
I mean, there's a long tradition in comics of having your heroes fight each other. And
Secret Wars, Spider-Man whips the entire X-Men team in like 5 pages.
Yeah, right. Right.
Well, that's fairly realistic, I would say. But
they when DC wants to have its heroes fight each other, they do it by making Superman turn evil.
Yeah.
Again.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And why doesn't Batman just run around with like a Glock filled with kryptonite bullets for when that happens? Because it seems to happen a lot.
Yeah. Well, probably because that would be a boring story.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Well, maybe they shouldn't have him turn evil again then.
Maybe not.
And yeah. Batman doesn't carry a gun.
Oh, that's right. That's why he came.
Lawn darts.
Well, he could carry the gun and toss it to Nightwing as needed. How's that?
Yeah. Now, did you notice that it's always they turn Superman evil?
Yeah.
Did you guys ever read Nemesis, Millar's book from a couple years ago?
Oh, that was the whole, it was basically Batman in white tights, and the concept of the book was, what if Batman was a dick?
Yeah, exactly. It was just this one guy's, you know, it was like a 5-issue thing of this one guy's revenge fantasy, how he would get revenge on a perceived wrong. But, I mean, why is it Superman turns evil? Why can't Batman turn evil? You know, I mean, why can't they go that way?
Because you want to root for Batman, I think, because he's the only cool one.
He's the underdog.
The thing with Superman, obviously, is that at the moment they've got the Doom thing going on, which is a physical change to turn him evil. You can use kryptonite on him. Batman, you have to actually convince him to do something bad, where Superman, you go, oh, we'll just chuck the MacGuffin at him that turns him evil, and that's why they keep using.
And that's their flagship character, too. So what are they saying about their universe, where they're, you know, the only way that you can tell a good story is to take the one thing that should represent all the goodness and everything whole about their universe and corrupt it?
I would argue that Batman is not and has never been their flagship character. I think Batman is their flagship character. I don't think Superman is the flagship character. I think Batman is.
Oh, now he is, yeah. I mean, you know, you can't walk down the street without seeing something with wings surrounded in yellow.
If we get much further on, we're going to have to talk about Man of Steel again, and please don't make
Well, hey, you know, since we're getting ready to transition from Jason to somebody else, it might be a good point to do a quick mention of the Supervillain Handbook that Jason Tondreau is currently working on.
So this is our new project for Icons, although my hope is that it has a lot of crossover appeal. We're gonna talk about 40 different supervillain archetypes, ranging from archetypes like the assassin to the cosmic menace and the nuclear nightmare and the power corrupted and the psycho villain and the wolf in sheep's clothing and so on. And much as I've done in previous books, the goal here is not to focus on the villain's powers, which are often kind of irrelevant, really, but rather on his story function. That is, what is the story that you use that villain to tell, right? So we'll have discussions of stories for each of these character archetypes, plus whatever powers and traits and abilities and other qualities they might have that are required or commonly seen in these archetypes. And some of them are, their powers are significant to how they're related. And then we'll create some stat blocks so you have quick and easy villains to go. And then after the Kickstarter is over, we're going to do a sort of expanded edition or deluxe edition where we'll actually create 40 complete supervillain NPCs with fully developed backgrounds and stories and everything in their own setting that's suitably generic so you can pull them out and drop them into your own setting without problem. And so it should be a lot of stuff for people. It's going to have basic – I'm trying to go something sort of really, really comprehensive about – all the different kinds of supervillains that are out there, giving you lots of bad guy stats with fully developed backgrounds and personalities, plus game stats, and we've got beautiful art already coming in for it. It's a lot of fun.
I guess I should mention first, there's going to definitely be a supers conversion as well. And let's mention the Facebook group. What's going on with that?
So what I did was I have a lot of people smarter than me on my Facebook group because. These are academics and comic nerds and a lot of people that I've known for a really long time, and they followed my work and I follow their work. And so what I did was I'm sort of crowdsourcing the book. So as I draft each of the archetype descriptions, and they each come out to about 1,000 words, and as I draft each of them, I post them up on the Facebook group and I get feedback from everybody that's there. So, for example, I try and start every one of those archetypes off with a quote from a famous example in the comics, you know, like, so for example, I just wrote up The Power Corrupted, which made it really easy because there's all these Dark Phoenix quotes. I mean, Dark Phoenix quotes are famous, so they were easy to find. But a lot of these characters, it's harder to find a quote for, you know, but a lot of fans, they already have their favorite quote from their favorite villain, you know, and so you can just tell me what the favorite quote is and I can use it. That helps a lot. Or maybe you have a favorite example of that kind of villain that I haven't remembered. Or maybe you know a famous story or a great story hook that a GM could use with that villain type. So all of these things people are throwing into the hat, and then I go back to my manuscript. I don't change it on the Facebook group because that's too much effort. But I take everybody's comments and I go back to my draft, and I incorporate all that feedback into the draft. And all of this will go into what we're calling the Starter Edition, which is the sort of basic book that anybody who donates to the Kickstarter will get as a kind of reward for donating. Ignore the squeaking. That's my dog.
That is awesome.
Yeah, she's got her toy. So it's a really fun project. I'm about a third of the way through the 40 archetypes now. Put out one about every couple of days, and it's really I'm having a lot of fun writing it. I think it's going to be very useful.
Oh, cool! And we'll have the links for the Facebook group in the show notes. And
we should call out like the other people that have been helping. Like Jacob Blackman has done a bunch of our art so far. He's turning up, and that's all up on the Facebook group, so you can see all of that. We started to reach out to some additional artists too. So it's been and Mike's really helped. The characters are all going to be in a sort of public domain setting. Like a lot of these villains. They don't make sense unless there's also heroes in the universe. Like, for example, let's say that you have a villain that's the evil twin archetype. Well, I can make a villain who's an evil twin, but unless you know who the hero is that he's an evil twin of, the villain makes no goddamn sense.
Right.
So I needed to know who are the heroes in this universe, and we decided to make them public domain superheroes. So we're going to use characters like the Black Terror and Amazing Man and characters that are in public domain. And so that led to the creation of a kind of a whole setting inhabited solely by public domain characters, including characters like Dracula and Sherlock Holmes, in addition to public domain superheroes from the Golden Age. And so all the villains that we make are also going to be public domain.
As will all the art in the book.
That's right, and as well as the art. So we're calling it the universe because everything in it belongs to you.
Catchy marketing, huh, Chuck? Huh? You can have that one for free. So, yeah, check it out. We'll put the link in the in the show notes. And yeah, Jacob's been doing a great, amazing job with his art. So that's definitely worth a look too. So, all right. Well, hey, thanks for mentioning that, Jason. And moving on, Walt. Yes, supervillains. Most favorite.
I'm gonna go a little bit different way than because you have an esteemed panel and they make very good points, ones that I can't even touch with a stepladder. And since we've already discussed my height, we're just gonna leave it at that. My favorite villain really isn't a character. It's the society that would need people to dress up in tights and wear a mask to actually defend the innocent. I mean that kind of thing, where you know what has gone so horribly wrong that somebody has to put on a cape and use catchphrases and beat people up, you know, or what has gone so right that you still need to do that, you know, that kind of society or that kind of that kind of setting, the environment that would require that. You know, that makes to me, I mean, we were talking earlier about, I believe it was Jason that was talking about story function. You know, you can't have this, you can't have this villain unless you know where he comes from or what the heroes are or what have you. And, you know, that setting, like, the setting of the Ultimates versus, the setting of Marvel's regular universe or, we were just talking about Nemesis, that dark city that he comes from, that he feels that, he needs revenge on everybody in it. You know, what came together to actually push somebody in that direction? And that goes back to the, the best at what he does kind of thing. Do all people start out evil? Is that just something you're born with? I mean, and those kind of, the setting that produces those origin stories that either give flair and flavor or make them just flop. I mean, that brings me into a villain more than just the villain themselves. Although I got to say, going back to Dr. Doom, the only thing I don't like about Dr. Doom is the fact that he constantly refers to himself in the third friggin' person.
I know a lot of sorority girls at Purdue did that back in the day.
there's this great bit in 2099 when he's like hanging out with some people from the future and they're like, "Did you really shoot the Baxter Building into space?" And he gets this kind of wistful look in his eyes and says, "Those were more happier times."
The worst villain to me are comic book writers. Comic book writers are my most hated adversary, because when they're good and they're writing a villain like Doom or anyone, and you can sympathize with the villain, like we were saying earlier, the best villains are not only good at what they do, but they're also ones that we can sympathize with and empathize with. Take the guy that just wanted maybe just a little bit more, so he did just that one bad thing, told that little white lie, or he took that pencil or stapler off somebody's desk, maybe he took a squeak toy out of a dog's mouth.
Sorry.
No, I'm kidding. Totally kidding. I have my dog here, but she's running from room to room chasing a cat. If you have that writer that's sitting there and pushing in an interesting direction that we can identify with or be horrified by and say, "Wow, that's an amazing villain." You know, Darth Vader, when he reaches across the expanse and says, "You're my son," or Dr. Doom, when he's sitting there and, not only is he fighting for the love of his mother, but, he's fallen in love with Storm. He's fallen in love with Sue Richards. This is a tyrant who can have anything he wants. And the one thing he wants most, he can ever have because of, circumstance, but when you have a writer that writes that, that's amazing. And you sit there and you put down the book and you walk away feeling like, you really have something. But when you got a comic book writer that just sits there and is just getting paid to put something down and he's got better things to do, so he just puts something down. I mean, to me, that's evil. You have this great device that you can tell stories in that can either teach or inspire or educate, edify or what have you. But instead you choose to just, write something that's only worth not even the paper it's printed on. To me, that sucks. And a hush falls over the room.
You made us think.
You got made us
better on us, and I think that's good. That's good.
Damn, that's deep. Well, I got nothing.
If comic writers are the worst villains, then they're winning, because
it's true.
Comics have kind of been bad lately. I don't want to be that guy, but I'm that guy because they're not good.
You and H should hang out more.
It's just like, wait, they're killing Captain America, we're going to have a different Captain America again? Didn't this happen like 18 months ago?
Well, right now Marvel's on a big, big diversity wave right now. And to be fair, I think it's interesting how they're doing it, comparing it with DC's attempt to also be diverse and failing. You know, like, DC will create all of these books that are supposed to be diverse with books like a Hispanic Blue Beetle and a Lesbian Question or Batwoman or whatever, and then all those books get canceled and kind of go down in flames. And Marvel's taking a very, I don't know, a different tack, I think, by using top tier characters like Captain America and Thor. We don't know how it's going to pan out because this news just broke over the last couple of days, but I think it's interesting.
Hold on, I'm going to tell you how it's going to pan out.
Okay.
Quickly. 18 months from now, this will all go away and there'll be something else.
Yeah,
and that's what makes modern comics terrible.
You're right, but that doesn't tell us about the quality of the stories between now and the 18 months from now. Like, are they going to use female Thor or black Captain America to tell good comics? Now, you're right. They will go back to normal and it'll be Steve Rogers again in time for the next movie. I get that. I totally get that. But are they going to rise to the challenge and tell good stories in the meantime? I mean, they told some pretty great stories with Bucky as Captain America.
Chuck would disagree with you on that, I think.
Well, yes, he would.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Chuck, didn't you actually get into it with Brubaker? How about that?
Briefly, yeah. Well, he disagreed with my analogy. Okay, Brubaker is on record as saying that he thinks Captain America should be Jack Bauer from 24.
Right.
This was before Bucky became Captain America. And so I made a comment that, well, great. So now he's got his wish. Bucky is Captain America's Jack Bauer. And he took issue with that characterization on the Bendis forums. But I don't know.
Well, that's a fair point, and I certainly see what you mean when you call him the Jack Bauer, and that you somebody who's, you know, who will have that "where's the bomb" moment, you know, where he points a gun at the terrorist's head or tortures him or something and gets information out of him, and
right. That
doesn't sound like Captain America to you and me, and I totally agree.
And by the way, I love Jack Bauer, and I love the Winter Soldier. I just don't think either one of them should be Captain America.
Yeah, right.
Well, the discussion about comic writers being the great villain here, I'm definitely sympathetic to the argument, but I think we may be pointing, at least in the current market, at slightly the wrong people.
Yes.
Because these days now that comics are becoming you know tryouts for multi-million-dollar movies, or at least that's how people see them. Comics I think maybe more so than any other time in my memory is now a top-down industry, and there may be better examples. These days editors increasingly seem to be a cog in a wheel.
Yeah.
I mean, do you honestly picture anybody with an editor title at either DC or Marvel to have the authority to come in? I've got it, transgender Aquaman. which I would read. I would read. Don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying. You know, it seems like more than ever the idea that it's a top down industry.
Yeah.
The tail wags the dog.
Yeah.
Based on the results we're getting, yeah. Based on the results.
Like television and film and video games.
Do you think that's why we're getting so many creators who start doing their own books, work at Marvel, and then go back to doing their own books?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest example of that one is the Fraction family, especially Kelly Sue DeConnick. You know, she created her own stuff and then started working at Dark Horse and started working at Marvel, and now she's back to doing her own stuff. And, you know, while everybody, you know, everybody lauds her for her Ms. Marvel, you know, her stuff like Pretty Deadly and all that other stuff, I mean, that's it's killing it right now in the market because it's...
Yeah, and it's not just Marvel either. I mean, we all remember there's been a huge raft of departures at DC.
Oh, yeah.
Under very spectacular circumstances. And I've heard George Perez talk about the horror story that was Superman, you know, that and it was exactly the sort of confusion that Chris is talking about. Like, you know, we're going to restart Superman, but nobody could even tell George Perez if Ma and Pa Kent were alive or not. You know?
Well, some of that's down to Grant Morrison and wanting to do things his way.
Yeah, Grant was sort of writing action comics by the seat of his pants, and so he didn't know. I don't know if Ma and Pa Kent are alive because I haven't had to use them yet.
I love Grant Morrison, but he should never be in charge of anything because he's insane, which is part of what makes him great.
Yeah, it is. It is, and I love his work too, and I like some of what he did on Action, but. When it got all caught up in the New 52, it became bigger than just Grant. If Grant can just do his thing by himself, like his run on Batman, when you know, nobody told Grant what to do, and he just sort of did his thing with Batman, and everybody sat back and watched the awesome, you know? But when he has to interact with other people, it becomes kind of this hot mess.
I think his run on JLA deserves to be called out as being especially good. I really enjoyed what he did with JLA in the 90s.
Well, I'm a big fan of it because it got a chapter of my dissertation.
Excellent.
Well, that's cool.
Because he did all these Arthurian themes with it. I mean, he had like the JLA table got 12 seats, and he specifically said at San Diego Comic Con that it was 12 seats because of 12 seats at the round table. And he did that whole Rock of Ages storyline, which he later revealed was all based on the Grail Quest, like character for character, beat for beat, was a Grail Quest story.
That was pretty explicit inside. I don't think didn't take a lot of analysis. I mean, there was a few panels with Green Lantern where it just seemed like, okay, I've read this before.
Yeah, well, what the funny thing was that, this is way off topic, but if you remember, like, there's this thing, the MacGuffin of that book.
The Philosopher's Stone.
The Philosopher's Stone, exactly. And the Philosopher's Stone, it turns out, was his metaphor for the Holy Grail. Well, a lot of us were like, well, yeah, he calls it the Grail at one point. Metron says it's the Grail, but he also calls it a million other things. And so we didn't really take it as a Holy Grail story very seriously until later on Morrison's blog, he basically unpacked the whole thing for us. Like Green Lantern is Percival and the whole thing. Like, he sort of unpacked the whole story for us. And it was like, oh.
See, that's one thing I don't like about Grant Morrison sometimes is some of his books you need a lot of unpacking, and you almost need like a DVD with director's commentary. Like, I don't understand what happened in Seven Soldiers to a high degree.
Yeah, I get most of Seven Soldiers, but there are large annotations. I mean, his book, The Invisibles, actually has an unauthorized guide to the Invisibles, which is as thick as a good trade paperback. That's just page by page, panel by panel, telling you what the fuck is going on.
Yeah. Or Sea Guy. I could use some notes on Sea Guy.
Sea Guy was cool. Invisible is one of my favorite books ever. I love it.
Listen, tell me why you like Sea Guy, because I have tried to like that book, and I just cannot get it.
It's got talking fish in it. Come on.
you just love it because it's crazy?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay, fair enough. All right.
All right, well, hey, since Aide, let's go to you. Favorite and least favorite.
Okay,
we've saved the bio for last.
Well, this is the thing. It's funny. See, I used to like the villains used to be like the guys you'd rolled out, and they'd be like the, oh, my God, it's him behind it all villains, which used to be Thanos, Galactus, you know, Ultron. And obviously they're the guys that are now everywhere because of the movies.
Yeah.
So Thanos is like, used to be, oh my God, there's, you know, is he going to show up? Is the Infinity Gauntlet being one of my favorite stories with Thanos in it, obviously. But he just seems to be everywhere now. He's on the front cover of the New Avengers, like the 8 months later thing. He's obviously, because he's going to show up in Guardians, again. They're just turning him into a run and mill bad guy. You might as well just set him up in New York and let him have an office there or something.
Okay. It's just, I know, it's incorporated.
It's just, yeah, exactly. It's just crazy. So they used to be the guys I go to. The currently, I think my favorite villain that is in a story at the moment, I think, has got to be Luther. With the thing he's doing with half manipulating Bruce Wayne to become a member of the Justice League after saving the Earth from the Forever Evil guys, and kind of liking the idea that he's actually somebody that people respect and kind of look forward to help them out, kind of thing. He's kind of seen what's, you know, I could actually be a Superman type character and kind of do my thing and not actually be, you know, kind of manipulate everybody. But he's kind of doing finding his Batman secret identity to do that as well. So he's kind of the guy I'm kind of thinking at the moment is probably one of my favorites.
That's a good choice.
Yeah, what did you think of the President Luthor storyline?
I quite like that. I thought it was quite interesting. The thing with Luthor is when you get into that kind of authority is you can't have him being discovered every time, because obviously you just go, oh, well, we'll just get rid of him. And so it's that the idea is kind of, he is like almost Batman's polar opposite. He's always got a plan. Yeah. So you can't find him out to be the bad guy behind everything. And it kind of got annoying. I was a bit annoyed when they kind of did that thing where he eventually got discovered. And, yeah. And then obviously they blamed it on Alexander Luthor at the end of that crossover, or which one it was anyway at the time. Infinite Crisis, maybe?
It was either Infinite Crisis or Final Crisis.
Yeah, one of those. And they basically, the Joker killed him off, and they said, oh, no, okay, it wasn't me that was doing all the bad things. It was this guy. It was pretending to be me. So, yeah, again, he had a plan. It was, yeah, that's pretty cool. So.
I think it was Infinite Crisis.
I think it is.
Because Final Crisis was the one with Libra, who was a really bad villain.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Basically, yeah. Shows up to kill John Jones and isn't explained in the series. There's some one shot later that actually explains who that villain was. So,
yeah,
it's one of the sins of Grant Morrison. In addition,
yeah.
To
yeah, I can't remember Lee, but that's really quite bizarre. Yeah, you're right.
He
killed
a bunch of villains. He amped them up, and one of the fire controllers stabbed John Jones in the first issue for no real good reason other than just to say, "Oh my God, they killed John Jones." And yeah. John Jones is kind of the helicarrier of the DC Universe. They kill him, but you know things are serious.
That's true.
Which is a shame, because he's a character I love. I'd like to see them do more with them. Dixon had a miniseries with John Jones for a few issues. That was a lot of fun. Just following his history through the DC Universe.
I'm surprised he's not got his new 52 series, to be honest. But, I mean, they seem to want to use him. Obviously, he was in Stormwatch, and now they've brought him into the new Justice League. So they seem to actually don't dismiss him.
Well, you guys haven't heard. DC's official position is that if you know who John Jones is, you're a loser and a virgin who will never know the love of a woman. You're not going to be into cool stuff like wanting to see She-Hulk have sex with the Hulk, which is what that character was all about.
Who's our writer there? His name is suddenly escaping me.
Goyer.
Yeah, that's right, David Goyer.
The man who gave us such awesomeness as Superman. Nice.
Man of Steel, yeah.
Yeah, Man of Steel.
Yay! It all comes down to Man of Steel.
Change the subject fast!
Okay, so worst villain. The worst villain. The only one I can think of off the top of my head. I mean, everyone's kind of got their own. Some of them have like a really cool story that will be like, okay, that's quite a clever use of him. The only one I can think of that I actually despise just by looking at him is the Owl. I just can't stand that whole kind of, I'm kind of look like Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, but I've got some punky claws and I've kind of got a half-ass Wolverine haircut. That just bugs the hell out of me every time.
Didn't Bendis use him in the Daredevil run?
Mark Waid is using him right now in Daredevil run.
Yes, it could well come back to be something really quite cool, but I remember that kind of like green coat he used to wear way back. Yeah. And I just hate it.
If I ever get a chance to write, you know, a big name Marvel or DC book, and I never will, so I'm safe saying this, but I would consider this a personal challenge. Like, take some villain who's just stupid, and rehabilitate that villain into somebody interesting. That would be fun to do.
But the thing is, what they'd probably do with him, they'd just turn into like a Venom Carnage thing, and all of a sudden, oh my God, Stiltman's gone crazy, he's killing everybody in the room, and that would be it. And that would be we've boosted Stiltman's profile. Now, that would be pretty much as far as they go.
He put one of his stilts right through Thor's chest and just punched his heart out.
You know, Mark Waid made Stiltman pretty cool. He had him in Daredevil about a year ago.
Yeah. So. I quite like Stiltman. I think Stiltman's quite fun. So.
He's a fun Silver Age villain, yeah.
Well, you know, the Owl is indirectly responsible for us having the X-Men villain Apocalypse. because the owl was originally supposed to be the big bad in X-Factor until the writer, whose name escapes me, went to his editor and said, and it's going to be the owl. And the editor said, no, it's not. So he had to make Apocalypse up out of whole cloth simply because his editor rejected it being the owl.
That was Louise
Simonson?
Was it Louise Simonson that was writing it then?
I'm totally drawing a blank.
When the book started? I believe
it was. Yeah.
You guys are bringing out some deep, deep comic trivia there.
Yeah.
I had no idea that the villain was going to be the owl.
The owl, of all things.
That's
the thing. I know you learn, right?
Kind of ripping into the orb, being the bad guy in the original Sins thing at the moment. So the guy I was talking to, my comic book supplier, and basically said there seems to be this guy who's writing the original Sins just seems to have made this guy and sort of trying to push it on him. So look, he is really cool. He's now the bad guy in the original Sin. Look, he's got an eyeball for a head. He's cool, and that's pretty much his selling point.
I don't know, that sounds like the makings of a great Venture Brothers villain. It's like a guy that would just hang around whining in the background, I've got an eyeball for a head.
I love the Venture Brothers. I got to check out this last season. But thing with the Venture Brothers is, like, you know, there's I kind of like mildly enjoy the entire episode, and like, you know, every episode or two there's a little like laugh out loud kind of moment, but a lot of it's just kind of like pleasant, amusing banter, you know what I mean?
Bob Layton created Apocalypse.
Huh?
Bob Layton created Apocalypse.
Thank you.
Bob Layton,
crikey. So, okay, well, cool. I guess it's back to me. I just wanted to pick a bone with the Joker. I don't know. Chris, are you the only one on this podcast who still reads current DC?
No,
apparently.
Did you guys read Death of the Family?
Yes.
All right. If I'm not mistaken, didn't the Joker knit a clue mural for Batman from the intestines of like 42 victims?
Yeah, I believe so.
Well, if he didn't, you need to pitch that to Dan Didio, my friend, because you'll be cashing DC checks in no time.
And then the climax of this story arc, he kidnaps all of the Bat family and drives them all temporarily insane, and they start fighting each other, and then somehow they figure a way to get sane again, and it's. Shit like that. They're turning him into a Saw villain.
Yeah, it's not the Joker's fault, though. I mean, the Joker's a great character. He's just badly written.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah. Just the way they're making him more of a horror villain than a supervillain.
Well, I want to know where they're going from there, because apparently Joker's daughter has his face. So what's he going to come with now when he comes up? He's going to have this kind of, you know, skinless face. He's got nothing for him to have on his face anymore. So
yeah,
he should wear a red skull mask. Wouldn't that be cool?
Actually, yeah, that'd be quite clever. Yeah.
Well, the red skull is the most DC Marvel villain there is. It makes sense.
I've always kind of I wish they would retire the Reds. You guys still there?
Yeah.
All right, sorry. I thought we had a hiccup there. I think he's just, I don't know. I always got sick of seeing Cap fight him. I thought, I can't find someone more interesting than the Red Skull, because he was fighting Nazis in 19 whatever. Or.
I think there's some real stories left in Red Skull. And in particular, I'm remembering Wade's run on Captain America when he wrote basically the Red Skull's autobiography issue that was like the story of the Red Skull from the Red Skull's point of view. And that that book got censored. Pages got rewritten, and Wade ended up disavowing it. And that's because there's very anti-Semitic language in the book, because the Red Skull is an anti-Semite. And the editors wouldn't let the book be published in that way. And so I think that there's, you know, with the things that the Red Skull represents have not been eliminated from our society. And as long as that's true, there are Red Skull stories waiting to be told.
And as long as we still have calendars, we'll still have Calendar Man stories to be told. So
that's true.
you jerk. Here I am trying to be serious.
But, you make a good point, Jason. You make a good point.
See, that's part of the problem with movie Red Skull, because movie Red Skull is like, okay, I'm not a Nazi, I'm now a member of Hydra. What do Hydra do? Well, we kind of do some stuff, but we haven't got really much motivation. Whether we're a Nazi, then it's like, yeah, you kind of see where they're coming from. This is the Nazis. You're supposed to like it because of the things they've done.
The funny thing cracks me up about Hydra in the movies, that Hydra is apparently so hardcore that they were too hardcore for the Nazis.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Nazis are like, oh, no, no, you've gone off the edge.
Well, no, because it was also, like, by choice, right? Because the Red Skull makes mention in the movie, he's like, all that master race stuff, that's just dumb. Look, I just want powerful Indiana Jones-style mystical artifacts. Is that too much to ask for? And then I want to rule the world.
Yeah.
We're Hydra. We're an organization dedicated to being evil, but in a way that won't offend the international box office or any domestic political interest groups.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly.
That's right.
What if we were just evil because it's cool? That's kind of what Hydra's like.
Yeah.
No, if we're going to talk about great villains, I have to give Hydra some serious chops as an organization. I mean, the logo and the mottos, you know, the cut off one head and two shall take its place, Hail Hydra, all that stuff. All that stuff sends shivers up my spine still. I went out and I broke open the old Nick Fury, the original S.H.I.E.L.D. comics, and read some of those stories over again lately. And Kirby was just doing – he was so hot when he was making that stuff.
Yeah.
So that, like,
Nick Fury?
Taking it back to role-playing game stuff, that's why I like Shadow in Mutants Masterminds, because they're kind of that Hydra-style bad guy. They're kind of in the shadows all the while, doing their thing, but they're kind of, yeah. If So I've used them quite a bit, and everyone think I'll get sick of them. It's like, oh, it's Shadow again, here we come. Yeah.
Well, hey, change the subject a little bit. Chuck, I understand that you've got a return to game design you'd like to tell us about.
I've for the last 6 months or so, because I have a day job now, and that takes a lot of my writing time away, but it also lets me work on something until it's done, right? So I've been designing a zombie game that if you were to read a certain comic book about dead that walk around, you would be able to emulate that comic in this game.
No idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, no one does. it's not very popular.
What's that one? The Shamblers? I don't remember that one.
I had to read that book recently, by the way. That book that we're not naming.
Okay. Why do you say, like, I had to read it? I love it when you said this many times.
It's like homework.
I had to, it's so dear.
I don't think Jason actually enjoyed it, did you, Jason?
No, it was okay. I mean, I had to read it because my students have read it, and they watch the show. And because I'm Dr. Comics, they expect me to know it. And so when they talk about Walking Dead, I can either be stupid or I can respond intelligently. So that means that I have to read it. But
well, it's really the comic doing the best stuff right now. So, yeah, I mean, I if I was in your class, I would expect you to know it.
Yeah, totally. And I totally get that. So I did read it, and I have great respect for it, but it required an enormous amount of labor and man hours. I do think that it's well written. I think it's a very impressive project.
I can just tell by the way you're describing it. You're trying to praise it, but you hated it.
No, I didn't hate it at all. No, that's not true. No, I did not hate it. But what I can say is that I'm going to let you write the zombie game, not me. Right?
Sure.
We should all write the games, the genres that we love. And you love the zombie genre. And I have no, it's like, it's boring to me.
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah, good.
I actually think the Walking Dead is actually what converted me. Because I think as a concept, the zombie apocalypse is incredibly dumb. It's a concept. It's a concept that says the slow, dumb, unarmed humans are going to defeat the faster, smarter, armed humans.
Right.
So as a I always just wanted to shake my head and walk away. But
tell us about your game.
What I love about it's really not an attempt to do an all-encompassing zombie game. It is really a specific subgenre that is represented by the George Romero movies and the Robert Kirkman comics, where it's not about the monsters at all. It's about the people. And so what I wanted to design was a game where you're not going to be rewarded for exploring. You're not going to be rewarded for fighting, but you are going to still have all those traditional RPG trappings of I'm going to level up and I'm going to get more competent as I level up. And so I wanted to try to make a real kind of survival emulation game where the two things are, can you get along with the people around you, and how long can you survive? And nothing else matters. Mechanically.
Interesting. What kind of system are you based on?
It's a new system designed from the ground up for the game.
Cool.
Oh, okay. Sweet. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it's a percentile system. Instead of experience points, because again, I didn't want to, you're in kind of a catch 22 when you, anytime you have a traditional RPG system, then the players are basically forced to put themselves in danger to get more powerful. Whereas if you look at the zombie fiction that I'm trying to emulate, everything revolves around, I just want to find a place that's safe.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to find a prison and I'm going to lock myself in.
Yeah.
And so the only measure of gaining experience is how long you've survived.
Cool.
If you've survived for 6 months, you are probably going to be more powerful than someone who has only been surviving for a week.
Okay, that makes sense. So is your zombie plague a slow progress across the country, or is it all dumped in one, kind of everybody wakes up and then everyone's dead at the same time? This is a weird thing, obviously, with the walk. I mean, I'm Walking Dead, I've only read the first companion, so I've still no idea if they've actually got into the actual cause of it. Obviously, with the TV series, they haven't, so nobody really knows what's happening outside that small kind of community of, you know.
Right. my conception of it, and I believe this is how it generally happens in zombie fiction generally, is that it kind of happens all at once, or it happens very quickly. Generally speaking, the people you meet, now everyone does not necessarily level at the same rate. There is, over time, you're going to have a chance to level. It might happen and it might not, but so that's kind of and I'm not totally sure I'm happy with it just being random, but that's kind of my way around everyone being the same level, which honestly, you know, that's kind of the way third edition seemed to have been designed, but
well, everybody levels at the same time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. As you like, if you were fifth level, a city guard in a standard D&D game was going to be around your level. And if you're a 10th level, a standard guard in a D&D game was going to be around your level, right?
Yeah. See, I tried to run a D&D campaign like that. It basically said, you're going off in the forest. Oh, there's a green dragon there, but you only have three? Oh, so I didn't realize. But yeah, that it's quite nice to be able to say, okay, well, you find your way out of that situation at your level against this bad guy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So are you planning on kickstarting it, or when do you think you're going to release? Are we still in development? How's it looking?
My initial conception of the game was that it was going to be around 80 pages long. It's currently about 150 pages long.
Oh, okay.
I
remember in the past, you know, you were really great at presenting a world in as few pages as possible, but you've got to create a whole system here, and so it's just naturally going to be bigger.
And I think this fits really well. Like, really what I always tried to do, as I look back on the other games I've designed, you know, like when I did Blood and Fists for D20 Modern, yeah. I like to emulate specific genres. And so that's really what I'm trying to do here, and I'm trying to narrow it down as much as possible. It is at its foundation, however, I wanted to get the combat right, so I also think it would wind up working really well for a military game in a lot of ways, but
Okay, so are you going to kickstart it? When do you think you're going to release?
I'm not going to kickstart it. I'm self-funding it. And I'm going to release it when it's done.
Okay, cool. We'd like to have you back on to give updates as it progresses, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Yeah, see, I love zombie stuff. I had all Flesh for ages and never actually got around to running a campaign of that, and there's various other stuff that it's like, oh, Resident Evil, let's try and do a Resident Evil style game, and never actually got around to it. So a system that actually allows you to run something like that would be fantastic.
And I'm glad, because you know I'm glad that there's other people that want to write these games, because these games are popular and they deserve to be played, and lots of people are going to get great enjoyment out of them, and I'm glad, because I want to write Supervillain Handbook. Yeah.
I'm surprised there's not more, to be honest. It's quite, like you say, we're Walking Dead taking off. You'd have thought that would be like the thing that everybody jumps on. You know, it's right. Like, okay, zombies would be the thing. I don't remember seeing many at all.
Yeah, because All Flesh is an old. I mean, that game's
been out. All Flesh is ages old, yeah.
There's a couple zombie games for Savage Worlds, which are pretty popular.
Right.
Uh-huh. I'd have to look them up, but...
So that's pretty weird. It's expansions for existing systems rather than proper real new stuff. Yeah.
You gotta keep in mind, gaming is a niche, and it tends to be a niche of 40-year-old guys who tend to be nostalgic and play things they're comfortable with. So, I mean,
well, sure, but again, going back to, you know, Dawn of the Dead is a movie that... To me, the thing that Walking Dead does that's so great, Walking Dead is really an extension of Dawn of the Dead, to where, like, if you watch a typical George Romero movie, the characters, zombies have run wild, they want to find a place that's safe.
Yeah.
And they find it, and then something goes wrong, usually because human beings are you know, jerks, by and large. And the zombies get in, and then they flee, and the movie ends.
Well, you know, George Romero himself would drop dead at hearing you say that.
Oh, okay.
Romero is not a fan of The Walking Dead.
Yeah, I've heard.
Huh.
Tell why. What's his problem?
Well, it depends on what mood you catch him in. If you catch him in a good mood, he'll make some joke about you know, about his about the zombies on The Walking Dead being too fast. You know, he pretends to be this aging zealot for slow, shambling zombies.
Yeah, but he made a movie with fast zombies, didn't he?
No.
The remake of Day of the Dead had fast zombies, I believe.
Yeah, was that not him?
That's if you get him on a good day.
I'm trying to get. The only thing I can think you're thinking of are the new trilogy that he did up in Canada. I only saw those once a long time ago. I don't remember the zombies being especially fast there. But at any rate, the more pertinent reason why he says The Walking Dead has no politics. He says all of his zombie films are very political, and since there's no politics no commentary on contemporary politics in The Walking Dead, it just seems like a great waste of time to him.
Wow, I would disagree with that.
Yeah, see, the government
totally.
That's so politics.
Yeah,
that's like community versus community. That's massively.
Well, that's George Romero. Let Professor McLaughlin give you his take on it. Okay, I think when George says there's no politics on it, I read that as it isn't written by a bunch of guys still bitter about Nixon and Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I think George is going to say, "How dare you not stick it to Tricky Dick with your zombie show?" excuse me. He did update it to hate George W. Bush in the middle of the last decade, because really, how much more groundbreaking could you be than be anti-W, right?
Right. Yeah, and yeah, I don't know. Wow, that's kind of crazy. Well, and the zombies in The Walking Dead are not really all that fast either. I mean, honestly, the characters in The Walking Dead are by and large only endangered by other humans, right? I mean, or at least that's the most dangerous thing they face is each other, and that's a great idea.
Mm.
Yeah, we're the real monster. Everyone knows
exactly.
This.
It's like Aliens. The guy from Wayne and Mutiny is the real bad guy. The aliens outside are going to rip your head off, but he's the guy who's manipulating everybody to basically say, actually, I'm going to do my own thing and kind of screw you guys. They're the guys you got to worry about.
Yeah, we are the Walking Dead, right? I mean, that's the theme of the book.
Yes, there actually came a moment where Rick basically looks right out at the audience and says... you know, the Walking Dead are not the zombies. The Walking Dead are us.
Yeah, that's a line. Yeah, it's a line straight from the book where he's talking. Yeah, and it unpacks the whole metaphor, like, because in reality, I mean, let's face it, aren't we all? We're all walking dead, right? I mean,
yes.
The arrow of time has one direction, and it always ends in the same place.
Yeah.
And when it's doing that, I think it's really cool.
Oh, you highbrow motherfuckers, man. This is.
I was going to make a really obscure Star Trek reference then, but.
We're talking funny books, guys. No, I that was a very erudite observation, Jason. I can't disagree. Although I just to quibble, I thought Walking Dead referred to, you know, the mental state of the survivors in The Walking Dead.
Well, so on the surface, what he's talking about is the fact that they've all actually already been infected.
Mm-hmm.
That yes. Everybody that's alive has actually already been infected, and so they actually are already zombies. They just haven't died yet. On the completely literal sense, that's what he means.
Right.
But if you wanted to say that he also means that psychologically we're all damaged, well, sure, it can mean that too, right?
Okay.
Well, but what he also means, and I think in the context in which Rick actually says that in the book, it also kind of brings to mind that that classic post-apocalypse quote that the living envy the dead, right?
Yeah.
You know, which is something you see in a lot of post-apocalypse and dystopian fiction, is that the ones who have died are really the lucky ones,
right?
From a certain point of view.
Yeah.
And so, getting back to the game for a moment. So, like, one of the other things I tried to do is I took a page from Call of Cthulhu, and you have your physical health, but then you also have your mental health, because really, again, looking at this genre, a lot of times that's the real bad part. Like, if you look at Rick as a character, he really has gone from being the nicest guy imaginable to someone that you wouldn't want to sit in a room with.
Yeah.
Not to mention Carl.
See, Carl might be my favorite character in The Walking Dead.
Oh, my friend hates Carl. He despises Carl's, TV
Carl's,
Carl.
Carl's moment for me, well, yeah, on the TV show, he's not as cool. But in the comics, here's the moment at which I became Carl's biggest fan. One of the kids has just being surrounded by death and fascinated with morbidity, as we saw, you know, in the real world during the Black Plague, has actually killed one of the other kids to just, like, play with his guts. He wanted to see what a fresh one looked like, quote unquote. And so the adults discover this, and they've got the murderous kid in a van, and they're just freaked out. They can't figure out what to do. And Carl just waits until they all go to sleep, and he slips out of his tent, and he opens the van, and this other little kid looks at him and says, "Carl, are you afraid of me?" And Carl says no, and shoots him in the face, and then goes back to bed. And so that, to me, it's this kind of terrifying vision. Like, Carl is was raised in this world, and he is perfectly suited for it in a way none of the adults are.
Yeah, I would agree with that. His story arc is one of the most compelling in Walking Dead. And I can quibble, and I have quibbled before with Kirkman's writing style, but yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. And I look forward to seeing your game. I'm not going to ask you again, because I know it's still in development. Any kind of rough ETA later this year, early 2015, or anything?
Late this year is my goal.
Zombies for Christmas?
Yes.
Okay, cool. You got an artist picked out yet?
Yes.
And we don't want to put it yet.
It's a secret.
Not.
We don't have. If you're not comfortable, it's cool, man. I was just asking.
It is Alex Williamson.
Oh, okay, cool.
Standing. Great. Good.
He does good work.
Yeah.
He was recommended to me by the gentleman that I sold Vigilance Press to, James Dossie, and I asked him to send me some zombie samples, and he did, and they were pretty outstanding.
Thanks.
So
Alex does great work. That's a great benefit to the game.
Sweet. Okay, we'll look forward to hearing more about that. I need to get things wrapped up here. Anything else you want to touch on before we sign off?
No, I've not had a rant this time around. So.
thanks for inviting us, Mike. It was a lot of fun.
No problem.
Yeah.
And thanks to our listeners. I'll catch you next time on the Banff Podcast.